The audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. I hope you all are stacking responsibly with Swan Bitcoin. That is live now officially, and that is really exciting to finally get to use this thing. And a major thank you to those guys for supporting the show. We have got a great little read today from Rollo McFlugel from the Rollo and Slappy show. If you haven't listened to that, I'll link to it in the show notes so you can check it out. But it's titled, Bitcoin Fulfills the Idea That Money is Agreed on by Everyone. And this is a critical idea that most people don't realize is lost in our society. I mean, I imagine most Bitcoiners do, but I really liked the way this article laid it out. So let's go ahead and jump into this, and then we'll talk about it a little bit afterward. But this is from the Inside McFlugel's Mind blog on McFlugel.com, titled, Bitcoin Fulfills the Promise That Money is Owned by Everyone. One of the biggest lies in recent times is that inflation is good and necessary for a healthy economy. Suggest that inflation actually signals the opposite, and the fashionable but deluded response usually entails a comment about how things would come to a screeching halt if there were no inflation. While this is aggravating, what's worse is that it illuminates the acceptance of the even more insidious lie that money ought to be controlled by a central authority. The reality is that what money is ought to be decided by everyone who agrees to use it. And when I mean everyone, I mean every single individual must agree on what money is for it to be in good moral standing. This consensus is not to be confused with the majority rules system. For a change in the monetary standard to be ethically permissible, every single person participating in that standard must be on the same page. The fiat system has made this concept difficult to grasp, so let's consider how the previous hard money standard, gold, was arranged. Gold was denominated in units of weight, such as ounces, and was minted into coins for ease in exchange. The minters put special markings on their coins to signal to users that the weight of the gold denoted on the coins could be trusted because of their reputation of being honest and forthright. Since it was the amount of gold in the coin that mattered in determining its monetary value and not so much the other features of the coin, if people discovered that the coins were clipped, they would naturally trade these coins at an appropriate discount until they were melted down and reminted honestly. In many cases, the prince or other governing authority was entrusted with these minting duties. But despite being the ruler of the land, he was not meant to also have dominion over the money he minted. In his treatise on money, De Moneta, Nicolas Aresme made this point abundantly clear in Chapter 6, Who Owns the Money? Aresme wrote, "Although it is the duty of the prince to put his stamp on the money for the common good, he is not the lord or owner of the money current in his principality. For money is a balancing instrument for the exchange of natural wealth, as appears in Chapter 1. It is therefore the property of those who possess such wealth. For if a man gives bread or bodily labor in exchange for money, the money he receives is as much his as the bread or bodily labor of which is, unless he were a slave, was free to dispose. For it is not the princes alone that God gave freedom to possess property, but to our first parents and all their offspring, as it is in Genesis. Money, therefore, does not belong to the prince alone." When you frame money the way Aresme does, that it is, quote, artificial riches, and that it does not directly relieve the necessities of life, but is an instrument artificially invented for the easier exchange of natural riches, end quote, it starts to make more sense why changes must be agreed to by all. If the members of a society agree that gold is money, then the additional supply of money only occurs when natural riches are first created in the economy. Anyone is free to try to go out and find gold, but as it continues to be mined, it becomes more difficult to find. It is only the increase in the value of gold that incentivizes the expenditure of resources to search for more. Unless, on the off chance, that a massive vein of gold is discovered, this market process ensures a stable, if not steadily increasing, purchasing power of the gold money. The increase in supply of the gold helps it to be distributed across the economy without it becoming so value-dense that divisibility becomes an issue. As a result of all this, gold becomes a reliable tool for transporting value across time and space for managing uncertainty. Imagine Alice mixes her labor with some flour, water, yeast, and heat to bake a loaf of bread and, as a result, adds value to society. Bob deems that addition of value to be worthy of 1 ounce of gold and trades that gold for Alice's bread. Alice can then hold that ounce of gold until she finds a trading partner to exchange it for the natural riches she wants to use. In the meantime, what happens if Chuck decides to add some counterfeit gold that goes undetected as fake to the money supply? The value of Alice's ounce of gold will be diluted, and she will be impoverished as a result. She has no incentive to want Chuck to add counterfeit gold to the supply that only he benefits from at the expense of her and everyone else's diminishing wealth. If Chuck and others did a lot of this, it could have disastrous effects on the economy. They wouldn't be bound to the normal market conditions that require work before new supply is added to the money stock. Unfortunately for this monetary system, gold has flaws whose systematic exploitation brought us to the fiat system that we have today. Gold has properties that required centralization to better leverage its usefulness as money, and that centralization ultimately resulted in a transition from gold money to gold-backed money certificates to unbacked paper money. Under this paper money fiat system, central banks and governments work together to add new supply to the economy and take full advantage of the seigniorage. Of course, they do this without any explicit consent whatsoever from the people whom they force to use their money. The obvious and demonstrated result of such a fiat system is high inflation. Given a free market that allows for competition among currencies to be used as money, Thayer's law informs us that people will choose the appreciating one to the depreciating one. Payment would be demanded in the harder currency, and a premium constantly increasing to infinity would be required for payment in the easier currency until it was simply no longer accepted. So if people wouldn't be incentivized in the market to choose this money, how can we have this fiat system? Legal tender laws force people to use the government's fiat through the threat of violence. But this threat of violence can only get governments so far. Heavy-handedness can easily breed contempt and stir up negative emotions. A much more effective way of gaining cooperation is to trick people into believing that the fiat system is the best thing out there. Inflation is sold as good and important, and the consequential rise in prices across the economy is cleverly referred to as an adjustment in the cost of living. People are told of how they now have access to cheaper credit and can finance the purchase of things they never could buy before. They're told that consumption is what drives the economy, and savings are decried as selfish. But what's never explained to anyone is the cost of all of this. Those being enriched by the fiat system don't want you to know that their control of the money system is the ultimate case of the fox guarding the henhouse. Of course, they want you to believe that while maybe they're enjoying some benefits from this system, it's really all of you who get the most out of it. When new money is added to the economy, it benefits those closest to the money spigots, the government. The government can use this new money before the rest of the economy feels the effect of the loss of purchasing power resulting from the increased supply. The first to use the new money can spend it as if the supply hasn't been increased, since that information is not yet well known through a change in prices. As the money flows through the economy, the prices adjust upward, and those with the smallest amounts of money are hurt the most. Who would choose such a system where their money would be worth less tomorrow than it is today? Fortunately, Bitcoin returns us to a system where money is agreed upon by all, by making it considerably harder for someone to rig the game to steal value from others. Running a full node allows you to fully validate all new supply added to Bitcoin's stock and check that all transactions follow the rules. If someone wants to change a parameter in Bitcoin, they must first convince everyone else who runs a node to change their software to be in consensus with the new rule set. This ensures that no one is extracting value from someone else without their prior consent. This is an ideal system because while there is plenty of money to be made by adding new bitcoins to the supply, cheating will quickly leave you nothing to show for your work in mining the next block when it is effortlessly rejected by the node operators. Bitcoin helps us to rediscover what was known by everyone during the time of Aresma, that we should view those who violate the property rights of the owners of money as the thieves that they are. All right, let's take a quick break, hit our sponsor, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about this piece and how we can kind of relate this to the current goings on and what the bailouts and the printing of $1 trillion to keep prices where they are now. How is that stealing the money from savers? Because I think there's a couple of nuances there that aren't immediately obvious. So let's take a quick break and then we'll jump back in. All right, don't forget, I will link to the Rollo and Slappy show in the show notes, as well as the blog. There's a lot of great content to dig through, and they have a really fun libertarian podcast. So if you were looking for a good recommendation there, that is definitely one to check out. So, this was a really great little piece. I read it not too long ago, and I was like, oh man, this is definitely going to be a good one to do on the show. It also got me thinking about, most people, I think, don't understand. Well, I'll kind of give the context of why this popped into my head. So, in the conversation actually yesterday published, but it was a conversation last week with Pete Rizzo, is that he talked about how the narrative of money printer go burr is actually a little bit dangerous, because right now we're actually going through massive deflation because everybody needing to get cash positions. So cash is actually more valuable than it's been in a very, very long time. And they are trying to combat that by making a ton of new capital. And essentially what's happening is that a 10-year price imbalance, really a 40-ish year price imbalance, but let's just take this out of context of since 2008, a huge over-leveraged price imbalance is being corrected for, and the real price of capital is being revealed to us. So that's what's happening in this massive deleveraging. So we could actually end up with quote unquote no inflation, even at the end of them printing $6 trillion, $10 trillion to prop this thing up, helicopter money to the people, bailouts for all the airlines, et cetera, because what they're trying to do is prop up the current prices today. So it kind of leads to a question, is that there's no outright incredible price inflation that comes away from this. How are savers really being stolen from? It will really kind of obscure that narrative and cause kind of make this disconnect. But the savers are actually being robbed profoundly. And the reason is because the price distortion has happened in the last 10 to 20 years. The current prices today that savers are having to pay for housing, for stocks, for stocks that don't even produce positive earnings, for any and all assets, for education, for healthcare, for all of these goods, the prices that we're being forced to pay are drastically higher than the actual price, because it's being chased by 90% of the funds that are chasing it are loans. It's liabilities that are funding all of these high prices. So what's essentially happening in the market is that it's trying to adjust to the real price of capital. And in doing so, everything should be going on incredible sales. That there should be a 50% cut across the board of prices. And that is how the savers are rewarded, is that they, even having saved the tiny amount of money possibly that they did in the last 10 to 20 years, because they're still the only ones with any capital to back a loan, they should get fire sale prices because they've been getting screwed for 10 years on high prices. This is when their savings should be rewarded, when they should be applauded for being the only ones that didn't overconsume massively for the last 20 years by having now the access to all the real wealth, all the natural wealth, the natural riches, which I love that De Moneta or whatever, that little like section that he grabbed from there about how the prince doesn't own the money or whatever, and this is about natural riches. It's amazing how core to the idea of money, the fact that it's just a proxy, that all it does is account for the labor that you used to that you produced in the past. It's the fact that you made bread and then exchanged it for money. You should have the choice. We should all have the choice as to what that money is. That money is owned by us because our labor, our lives, and our production, our property is owned by us. You cannot disconnect the two. They are one and the same. And there's just an amazing element to the characteristics and the nature of Bitcoin that you can run a full node and choose without question what your monetary policy is. And no one can change that. That anyone who changes it simply punishes themselves by evicting themselves from all those who choose their own monetary policy. And that's why this has always been about sovereignty. That's why this has always been about securing a monetary policy. And if that comes at the expense, at the temporary trade-off for the number of transactions we can do, yes, absolutely. We must give that up, because transactions are pointless if it doesn't mean anything about the property or the wealth that we created in the past. If somebody can just arbitrarily create counterfeit new coins, counterfeit new money, and consume resources from the economy that they never produced, well, then not only do you have a deeply imbalanced economy, but you have all the people who are actually producing the goods, who are actually saving their consumption and being frugal and making the responsible decisions, being wiped out, being slaves to those, literally, like their property being stolen, the value, their skills, their knowledge, all being stolen from them by someone who simply has the money printer. And it's not simply about prices being kept stable. It's about prices reflecting the truth of the economy, the reality of real goods and capital in the economy, which is what we do not have by any measure of objectivity. Every important, meaningful price is horrifically manipulated and by the money managers. And how obvious could it be that there's going to be a class of people, an entire class of money managers and banks and corporations that are close to the money managers, that are close to the printing machine, that get all the money, that hugely and unfairly benefit from being the first ones to receive counterfeit money? Because as Rollo says in the article, the first person who gets to spend it in the economy has no idea that there's a new supply. None of the prices are adjusted. It's only through the continuous, through the cascading sets of exchange to exchange to exchange to exchange and people with the new money bidding up the prices that the inflation actually gets realized in the economy. So everybody who gets to print the money, everybody who's right next door to the printer and gets the money first, gets the money at the price as if there has been no inflation, as if not it's brand new money, but it's the same money as everybody else. And the people who are destroyed, the people who are hurt most of all, are those on, like, under wages, salaries, the people who work hour by hour, who have who are barely getting by to begin with and see their cost of living go up and now have to fight for years to get, you know, better minimum wage. You realize that under a deflationary economy, you never have to raise the minimum wage, that it just naturally would do that. Like, you could just eliminate that from all necessary political discourse. The argument would be in a couple of years down the road that we need to really lower the minimum wage because it's ridiculous. Half the economy doesn't can't produce enough value to pay for the minimum wage. And same with, and we talked about this in the past on the show. I went into probably like half an episode on a guy's take, I think, on how deflation, actually, no, it was deflation and liberty, I'm sure. Like, I know we talked about it there. But how, like, it puts the employee and employer relationship, it puts all the power in the hands of the employer. Whereas for the employee in the deflationary instance, where the actual productivity, increased productivity of the economy makes the money more valuable because so is our labor, so is our productivity. Well, that by default means that the employee doesn't have to do anything but be productive in order to have more purchasing power the next year. So in the inflationary instance, if they don't get a raise, they're losing money. They doesn't matter how productive they are, if they don't get a raise, they are losing money every single year. So they have to fight for a 5%. It is their obligation. It is their responsibility to go to the employer and beg for more breadcrumbs. It puts them uncomfortable. It forces the confrontation to the employee rather the employer. It means the default of not acting at all means you are getting robbed. However, in the reverse, in a deflationary instance, it means that all of the obligation is on the employer. They have to figure out how to constitute to not pay you more, to not give you the same salary you got. They have to come to you to negotiate the salary. When what actually happens is the default. Nobody does anything, and your salary simply goes up in value because the economy is more valuable, because the economy is more productive, and therefore the money is more valuable. So you get paid a fixed wage, you get paid more every year for doing that job. And then, of course, there's all the huge fallout from incentivizing people to go into debt by, you know, manipulating money this way. So not only is it their responsibility to get like a higher salary and all these things like through an inflationary system, but they're also in debt. So they don't even have any leverage to use against the employer. They can't quit their job. You have to have 2 months of savings to be able to just confidently go in and say, you know, screw you for not paying me enough and not being fair and giving me bad conditions. I'm out of here. I'm going to go take a week off and relax because I deserve it. And you've been, you know, treating me like crap for a year. And then, you know, I'll take a couple weeks to find a new job. But I've got 2 months worth of savings. I got 3 months worth of savings. I'm solid. Peace. The monetary policy of this country has literally trapped people. It is a cage of stress, of value theft. Like, I mean, that's the only way that you can put it, is that they need to be revealed for the thieves that they are. They are stealing value. They're able to consume and control and own trillions of dollars worth of assets, worth of houses, worth of cars, worth of all the things that we produce and takes our lives, our sweat, our blood in order to make. They are confiscating it through the manipulation of the money. And that's what Bitcoin is here to fix. And people who don't realize that this is the problem. It's not how much are we paying in visa fees. Like, that is not the problem here. The problem here is broken money. I think that's inherently what so many, I mean, it has to be what the all corners don't understand, because when you ask somebody like that what the monetary policy is, they're like, it's good. Like, they don't even care about the monetary policy. They just immediately go back to, oh, well, how many transactions can it do, blah, blah, blah. And it's just the core of the problem, the $100 trillion problem, is lost on them. And they spend all of their energy and efforts to solve a, you know, $100 billion payments problem, which isn't even really a problem. If we had a secure money, payment systems aren't like just this huge issue. Like, that's not where the bulk of society's problems come from. That's not where a 40-year debt imbalance comes from. That's not where 50% decline in a handful of days in the stock market come from. That's not where the bailouts come from. That's not where $83 trillion in debt comes from. The promise of Bitcoin is that we can own our money again. And I don't think there's a lot of people who don't even realize we don't. And I hope that Bitcoin will continue to make that more and more clear, because there is nothing quite so important to learn, particularly in these times, than the nature and consequences, the nature of our money and the consequences of its centralized control. So let's go ahead and close this out. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Rollo for inside McFlugel's mind for the blog post here. And really great read. Don't forget, I will link to the show as well as the blog, so you can check this out and see all the other posts that got over there. And don't forget to check out swanbitcoin.com. Those guys are awesome. They've been supporting the show, and there is literally no better place to auto DCA your Bitcoin savings. Play the long game and save in Bitcoin without having to think about it. Just set it and you're done. You will be forever stacking sats. And you won't have to deal with it. You won't have to think about it. And you can auto withdraw to your own keys, your hardware wallet, whatever it is. So don't forget to check out Swan Bitcoin. Much love for those guys. All right. Thank you guys for listening to The Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. That is me, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And tomorrow we are back. I've got a couple of really good reads lined up after this one, and we will be getting back into a little bit of macro discussion, just because there's the macro space right now is crazy volatile. So every couple of days there's another something to talk about. But we'll be hitting that in the next couple of days. Stay tuned. Don't forget to subscribe to The Crypto Economy. Don't forget to check out thecryptoeconomy.com. I'm just going to go ahead and push for anybody who's kind of new to Bitcoin. I highly, highly recommend Unchained Capital's Gradually Then Suddenly series. It's just amazing. So highly recommended, and you can get that on thecryptoeconomy.com/collections. You just go to the homepage, you'll see it up at the top. That whole series is gold. With that, thank you guys, and I'll catch you all tomorrow with another episode. Until then, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.